KCPW's broadcast from the Daily Buzz of the 2016 Sundance Film Festival is brought to you in part by Cotopaxi, Gear for Good, and from Naja Pham Lockwood and David Lockwood.
It's day one on the Daily Buzz here in Park City, Utah at the 2016 Sundance Film Festival. I'm John Wildman, and today we're going to be talking to some top industry journalists and programmers here at the fest and discussing the films to see and hot topics at the fest. We're going to talk to some Sundance films, The Lure and The Settlers, the boys from the Slam Dance Film Festival, and also the team from Kickstarter who has a presence on Main Street. All of that will come up after the news. You're listening to The Daily Buzz from the 2016 Sundance Film Festival here in Park City. We are on KCPW and online at kcpw.org. My name is John Wildman. I'll be hosting, and we're joined by a bunch of people here, along with my co-host Kim Boyner and our producer Irene Cho. But this is our Hot Topics subject segment. And with us are Jared Neese from South by Southwest, Eric Davis, who's written for a bunch of sites, so many that they couldn't even give me one or two on the list here, because it's just countless, the number of sites for Eric. David Fear from Rolling Stone, Mark Bell, formerly a Film Threat, and I think he's with writing for Hammer to Nail.
Yep. Yeah.
John Gann from the DC Shorts Film Festival, and Kate Erbland from IndieWire. And all right, so hot topics. Let's start off with we'll just start off with opening night. Somebody want to jump in on your thoughts on the Norman Lear doc? Anyway, feel free.
Yeah,
Eric.
It was really good. It was very good, you know, and it was very topical, too. You know, Norman Lear was a guy who produced a lot of life-altering shows, All in the Family, The Jeffersons, Good Times. And I feel like especially now, it's a doc that should be out there, because I think, if anything, it proves to network television that they need to take greater risks, that risks pay off. And I think that's why we're starting to see sort of this wave of nominations to folks like Netflix and Amazon and Hulu, because these are the people that are taking risks when it comes to content on the small screen. And so I think this is a documentary that a lot of people should watch. I don't think a lot of people know Norman Lear and everything that he accomplished. And this was a guy that walked away from his career when he had 6 of the top 10 shows on the air, which is incredibly ballsy. And he's still alive, and he's 92, and he's like younger than anybody in this room. So it was just really fun to watch and really cool, especially for me. You know, I grew up with those shows on my TV, and so it was cool to watch. I could watch an entire documentary just on All in the Family,
right?
And how that show came together. So yeah, just incredibly fascinating, and definitely one to seek out.
I think, you know, it was funny because he is, you know, an icon, you know, and such an influential figure. But I was talking to somebody about the documentary last night, and saying that it also is successful because you just want to hang out with him. And that documentary kind of allows you to do that. And you go and so it even transcends on that point as well.
It's interesting too how it's very much a time capsule of when he was really like hitting on all cylinders in the 70s. But it's also interesting to see how prescient he was. There's a Dinah Shore segment where there's a camera there, and he starts talking about, like, do you guys ever worry that this is going to be used for surveillance and a lack of privacy? At which point everybody in the audience is like, no, that could never happen, no. There's another thing where a sort of forgotten chapter of his life where in the early 80s he starts to take on the moral majority and the sort of burgeoning religious right. And clearly, that has not gone away. Clearly, the entire notion that there is a wacko factor of the GOP and the far right that's kind of making itself known again. It was one of those moments where you're like, who's going to be our Norman Lear? If Norman Lear can't be our Norman Lear right now, who's the next Norman Lear?
That's a good question. Today is kind of officially, like, you know, the first day where everything really, you know, kind of kicks into gear as far as the number of films. I've got to think that you guys are coming in here with films that you've been looking forward to seeing. Sight unseen. Let's talk to our two programmer dudes over here, Jared and John. What are you guys looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to a lot of things. There's a bunch of films from South by alumni, like Morris from America and Jacqueline Argentine, which I'm really excited to see. I'm really excited about all the VR stuff, like the Chris Milk VR installation that looks pretty amazing. It's this huge tent, 3 separate experiences, but it's a 6-minute, like, but it, It's just something that we could never do at South By. So it's right. like, it just like seems like a really cool. I mean, all their VR stuff seems really cool this year, all the new Frontier. I like a lot of the Midnight stuff, the genre films. Stuff that's not in Midnight that I really like is the Eyes of My Mother. And one of the good parts about being a programmer is right before Sundance is that we get a lot of the films submitted to us, too. So I've seen a good portion of the films here, and I can tell you the Eyes of My Mother is one of my standouts of genre films not in the Midnight program. And but yeah, there's a ton of amazing films. And
all right. Yeah, I agree about the VR stuff. I'm really excited about that because I really want to start working with filmmakers on using VR as a better storytelling tool. And so I think that's going to be really exciting. I can't wait to explore that. But I have programmers here to work on the shorts part. So for me, it's sort of like a feature vacation. So I'm really excited to see some stuff like the Mapplethorpe doc tonight and a bunch of films from the Middle East that sound really good, Halal Love. Which really sounds like it's right up my alley. So, yeah, it should be a good fest.
All right. I know Kim Boyner sitting to my right, for people who are listening, I know his also all about the New Frontier segment and she's pulling me into something because I'm constantly feel like I'm trying to catch up with transmedia, and I'm never there. Like, I'm constantly trying to catch up. So we're doing that. Kate, what's on your hit list?
Well, one of the things that I'm really interested in right now is there are two different movies that are about Christine Chubbuck, who is was a newscaster in Florida in the 70s who killed herself live on air. And it's a story not a lot of people are very familiar with. And it's funny that there's two movies this year. There's a feature from Antonio Campos and a documentary, sort of, from Robert Greene. And they're both here. And I'm really excited about both of them. And another standout that I think a lot of people have been talking about is Under the Shadow, which recently sold to Netflix for streaming rights. But I think that's something that's going to take a lot of people by surprise. Some people have compared it to Goodnight Mommy from last year. So maybe that'll give people a little push to go see that one.
I'm looking forward to seeing Robert Greene's film because he's one of those guys. We have guys that, you know, they make films on their own, and they're also part of other great films that they're like editing or they're shooting for other people or whatever. And he's one of those guys that you go, yeah, there's the films that he makes, like, you know, like Actress and films like that. But then there's also like a half a dozen films that he's part of the team.
Right.
For.
He's like a real like writer, director, editor. He's just in everything. And I really loved Actress. I love the kind of documentaries that he makes. And I think that kind of stuff really appeals to me, that blending of fact and fiction in inventive ways.
Yeah. Mark Bell.
Yes.
All right,
here we go.
It's your time now. What is on the Mark Bell?
I don't know what's playing this festival. No, I'm kidding. no, I'm really excited for Hunt for Wilder People by Taika Waititi. I've pretty much enjoyed everything that guy's made, and you know, from the short films to the features, and he's kind of become a staple here at Sundance. Like, he's actually been working with the festival too. I think he's hosting one of the awards too, and he's just a great filmmaker, and I love what he does, and I can't wait to see what this film is. And then I really want to see Brahman Naaman by a filmmaker named Q, just Q, the letter. But he did a film called Gandu, which played Slamdance, I think, like 4 or 5 years ago. And it was incredible, just an absolute mind-blower of a movie. And I cannot wait to see what he brought, I mean, to Sundance. And it's supposed to be, you know, almost like a teen comedy, like they're calling it almost like American Pie. And having seen Gandu, I'd have no idea how the guy who made that is going to give us a teen comedy, because it's got to be absolutely insane. So I'm really excited for those two. And I'm always, you know, really partial to the documentaries too. So I'm probably going to just hop into as many docs as I can find.
Right. Oh, so this is Irene. I'm curious. You guys are all festival veterans. What do you think are the themes that are coming out of this year's festival? Clearly there's a lot of VR projects, but other than that, what are you looking forward to?
Well, I think obviously something that has been kind of surrounding the screenings already, and also the topic of, you know, documentaries and features, you know, the gun debate, gun control. I mean, there's, what, is it 3 or 4 films that are here?
3, I believe. There's this very sort of art installation impressionist take on the mass shootings called Dark Knight by Tim Sutton, who was back here with Memphis, I think, a year ago, 2 years ago?
Yeah, 2 years.
There's a very kind of Dateline NBC-style documentary called Under the Gun that I believe Katie Couric is producing. And then the one that I'm looking forward to the most is this film called Newtown, which is supposed to be a very deep dive, very focused look at the tragedy that happened there. That's been the one that everyone's been kind of buzzing about, for lack of a better word.
There's also a VR installation that deals with gun control that's about two sisters who fail to stop their sister's boyfriend from shooting her.
What's that called?
I knew you were going to ask me that. It's called Kyra, I think. It's the girl's name. And it's an immersive, it puts you kind of in the living room as the experience happened with outtakes from the real 911 call as the event unfolded. So it's not with live actors, it's CGI, so I'm kind of curious if that's going to impact the experience for me, but I'm excited to see that.
I'm curious, Kate, when you are reviewing films, do you like to see them in advance or do you like to watch them with an audience? I'm curious as to what your viewing habits are.
I tend to, festivals or just regular, like reviewing in my regular life, I love to see movies in the theater. When you come to a festival like Sundance that has so much going on, it's not always possible. You do have to sometimes get a screener or a link and watch it on your computer, but it does not compare to the in-theater experience, especially at festivals where people are so excited and they're here because they're excited about films and they're looking forward to what's going to be the next big thing. So in-theater is always the way to go for me.
You know, I will say about links, though, when publicists have sent me screening links or screener discs, it's been wonderful because it's usually smaller films that I'm not able to fit in when I'm here. And it's also usually a lot of left field movies that I might look at the schedule and go like, oh, I'm not really sure I need to see that. Or maybe I'll catch this near the end of the festival. And the chance to actually see this in advance and in a lot of cases get wowed by stuff that I might have overlooked, it's invaluable. Because there's always the two festivals. There's a festival you go to and there's a festival you miss.
Yeah. Right.
And the ability to kind of cut down on that latter one.
And it's always the good films that you miss and you find out on when you're on the plane on the way home.
Yeah, cough, cough, James White, cough, cough. Yeah. That was the one that got away from me last year and I caught up with it after the festival and was so angry that I couldn't write about it in the context of the festival because I just loved that film so much. But
yeah, I mean, as a reviewer, I've always found that it makes the job of watching movies easier if you can get a hold of the movies, and if the filmmakers or the publicist or what have you make those movies easy to get to you, and then you can do your job easier and you can give eyes to films that otherwise might not get eyes and, you know, talk them up. And I think that's, it's helpful, but I do agree too. I mean, the theater experience is something that's irreplaceable and you have to put yourself through it. And particularly a festival like this, I mean, you go to these movies and you see 500, 600 people lined up for a movie and you go in and, I mean, if you see a standing ovation for a film at Sundance, like, it's a memorable moment. Like, it's something you're going to be sticking with for a while, so.
It's a screening versus an experience.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, we have to wrap up, and what we're going to do as before we wrap up is each one of you is going to give one title, the one can't-miss title. We'll start with Eric, and we'll just go down the line.
You know, I'm going with a documentary called Tickled about a journalist who infiltrates an underground tickling competition. I just think the synopsis for that is insane, and I want to know more about the tickling competition.
I'm just going to go with Kate Plays Christine. That's my pick.
All right. David.
The Birth of a Nation. Only because it means that I have to retire my hashtag Sundance So White. I think I was going to put on all my tweets, so I'm happy about that.
Mark.
I'm going to go with Yoga Hosers because I don't think anyone else here will say it. So,
Jared was shaking his head. That was awesome.
No, it's a great film. My film that I'm really excited about that I haven't seen is Swiss Army Man by the Daniels, who made last year's masterpiece, Turn Down for What, by Lil Jon.
And I think for me, I want to see the Gloria Vanderbilt Anderson Cooper film because as a kid, I always fantasized of being an offspring of the Vanderbilt. So, yeah.
All right. Kim?
Honestly, I'm most looking forward to checking out the 30 VR exhibits, especially the Chris Milk exhibit. There's a lot of cool stuff going on.
Okay, we get it. We're going to it. All right? We're going.
All of it, John. All right. Of it.
And I'll say, actually, the film that I've seen that I just love, which is The Lure, which is a magical realism musical horror film about mermaids.
You had me at mermaids.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it is kind of crazy in all the right ways. Love it. Okay, so that wraps that up. Again, we've been on our Hot Topics segment and talking with Jared Neese, Eric Davis, David Fear, Mark Bell, John Gann, Kate Erbland, with my co-hosts here, Kim Voyner, and our producer, Irene Cho. My name is John Wildman. I feel like I've just put out the lineup for a football team or something. All right, and once again, you've been listening to The Daily Buzz from the 2016 Sundance Film Festival in Park City on KCPW and kcpw.org.
You're listening to The Daily Buzz from the 2016 Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah, on KCPW and kcpw.org. My name is John Wildman. I'm here with my co-host Kim Boyner and our producer Irene Cho. And we're joined by the Kickstarter team right now. We have George Schmatz, Dan Schoenbrum. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, that was close enough.
All right. Liz Cook. And, I mean, Kickstarter has had a presence at Park City for a while now with the films, but this seems like almost like a little bit of a coming out party. I mean, you guys have a freaking house here now. So let's go ahead and brag about the films that you've got here, because you've got a few films, and then let's talk about, you know, the larger presence here and, you know, and why now.
Yeah, so since Kickstarter was founded and opened in 2010, we've had nearly 100 films that have premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, and, you know, every year it's a pretty diverse slate. This year we have 14 Kickstarter alums at the festival, and so that means actually 15 as of yesterday. 16 of yesterday. Oh, my God. But, you know, that's everything from people launching campaigns to fund development, to fund the very beginning of their filmmaking process, all the way through people literally funding to get to Park City, Utah to come premiere their film at Sundance. You know, and of course, Kickstarter is as much about, like you said, it's not just financing, it's a coming out party. So just like we're here announcing ourselves to the world, all of the filmmakers that used Kickstarter kind of utilize the platform as a way not only to raise money to make their films, but also to introduce that film to audiences and to get the word out about what they're doing to press, to industry, and all of that. So our slate this year is crazy, and it's pretty incredibly diverse, and I think we should all just kind of speak about a few of the different titles, but the only thing that unites them is that they are original, fresh voices doing new and different things, and that's everything from Penny Lane's Nuts, which is a documentary so strange, it's true kind of story about a guy who claimed to cure impotence through goat testicle injections in the early 20th century. It's everything from that to, you know, films about Maya Angelou, the film Spa Night, which is premiering tomorrow, the first feature by a director named Andrew Ahn. You know, it's a bunch of short films. The only actually independent web series at the festival, a web series called The Skinny, was Kickstarter funded. Just a really kind of like robust and diverse slate of films that I think speaks to the fact that there's not any one thing that works well on the platform. It's really like, if you're an artist that has an independent and creative vision, this is a place where you can bring that into the world.
All right, why don't we get Liz to chime in here? One, because on my descriptions, my little brief descriptions to let me know who everybody is here, it says Liz Cook is a badass. So I think she needs to talk. You know, and one of the things that I'm very curious about, and it seems that, you know, by this point in Kickstarter's life and the relationship with filmmakers, that filmmakers pretty much have an idea of what the process is, you know, to go through a Kickstarter and try to get funds. But it seems like you guys are now, you are, you know, kind of evolving to doing a little bit more promoting even after the fact. And I would love for you to talk about that, because I don't know that filmmakers are necessarily aware of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of different things that we do to celebrate the alumni. We have a Kickstarter film festival that we amped up this past summer. We actually took it to like over 30 theaters across the country, and a lot of the theaters were actually Kickstarter funded as well. We made the pages of the Kickstarter page, like when a project is funded, they're able to update their project page and sort of see, you know, put new images and put their information and that kind of thing. So there, people are able to look back at those pages and see what's going on now with those projects. We have an amazing editorial team that is able to shout out about really cool things that are happening. They're live tweeting and posting on Instagram and things that's like happening at Sundance now. So yeah, there's lots of good stuff that's happening.
All right, and I want to bring George into this, because George, and you are our genre guy. I've been told, you know, over time, it's, you know, John, you got to talk to George, because George is the genre guy, and you know, transparency, my film, The Ladies of the House, we did a Kickstarter campaign which was successful, and it was a genre film, and I'm very curious, is, you know, genre films, you know, seem to do quite well on Kickstarter, and I'm curious to see why you think that is. I'd love to hear you say why.
you think that is?
I think there's a few things. I think genre films, horror, sci-fi, animation, what have you, I think that community and that fan base tends to lend itself towards kind of maybe being more on the internet, more forward thinking on the internet, and kind of embracing fandom and embracing things earlier in the process than maybe others. Like, they have their ear to the ground to see, like, what's the new cool thing, I think. But also, on Kickstarter specifically, the things that tend to do well in that space are kind of effects driven or practical effects driven things, like kind of interesting looking things where you're able to kind of show the blood and guts or what have you. Or if it's animation, like, oh, that, like, cool stop motion, or like, really interesting storyboards or something like that. If you're able to put together an animatic for the project and just really kind of share your visual idea for the film with people, it allows people who are kind of coming to the site and coming to the project and seeing it, a reason, like, it kind of gives them a visual idea of what you're doing, and kind of it gives them a certain level of trust in you as the creator, that, oh, this guy knows what he's doing, or this woman knows what she's doing, or whatever, and I'll put in my $5, $10, whatever it is, to see this come to fruition and see it come out into the world.
So, George, why Sundance? Why is it important to be at Sundance? And do you think that genre filmmakers tend to flock to Sundance, and is that why you guys are here?
I mean, I think we're here really to celebrate all of our films here. We have on my side, like, on the genre space right now, I mean, counting animation as genre, we have a stop motion short here. We have a really strong doc presence this year, and strong narrative presence. So for me, it's really about coming to Sundance, talking to the people in the genre space. We are trying to get more filmmakers interested and get more filmmakers on site. So it's just really important to come here and kind of make connections and meet new people, and really show that we are a space, or we are a presence in this space, and we are looking to championing these types of filmmakers.
We also work very closely with Sundance. We've had a partnership with them since 2011. And, you know, they very early on in the Kickstarter process, before it kind of became almost a household name, identified this as a tool that really was going to help sustain their filmmakers, and really was going to allow, you know, these filmmakers that had maybe come to the Sundance Festival but were working on their next film and really struggling to pull it together in the right way, that this was going to be a great tool for them. So we started working with them really early on, and what that looks like is we work mainly with our artist services team, which is kind of the team dedicated to helping their alumni and their filmmakers long term. And when there is a Kickstarter campaign, or when they're thinking about doing a Kickstarter campaign, a Sundance filmmaker, they'll come directly to us, they'll come directly to Sundance, and we'll kind of all work together to make sure that it's done right. You know, and so we've always had a big presence at Sundance because, you know, we're so proud of, obviously, like, the fact that Sundance wants to work with us, and that we've had such an impact on that community. But for the first time this year, we decided to really go all out. You know, we've always done a few events, but the opportunity arose for us to have a lounge on Main Street this year. And we really, you know, we decided to treat it as an opportunity to not only celebrate Kickstarter and all of the filmmakers, but really just celebrate culture in general, because that's really what we're all about. And so we're doing panels and events. We're doing a karaoke roulette challenge, which is when you spin a wheel and you don't know what song you're singing until you start singing it. We're doing, that George can talk about, an immersive live horror experience with the guys from Blackout. Not all of the events specifically with people who've used Kickstarter for their films here at the festival, but certainly people in the community that we think share our ethos and this kind of idea of celebrating great culture, which is really what Sundance is all about.
It sounds to me you're really shepherding these filmmakers and showing them how to be successful. And it's very rare to be able to find companies that want to develop those kind of relationships long term. Is that what sets you apart from other,
you know,
crowdfunding sites?
I personally come from the nonprofit world. I worked at IFP, which is a great and very old filmmaker support organization, and one of the few here in the U.S. that's fighting the good fight still in a nonprofit sense. And coming to Kickstarter was just the perfect transition, because it really is the way that we as a company think about our identity is not as a tech company, is not as a for-profit endeavor. It's very radical in the sense that it's run like a cultural organization, and our goal is not go out and find big celebrities to do Kickstarter campaigns. Our goal is to go out there and impact culture. What that means is that, like, we see this as a tool of counterculture, and we see the money, both the money that we get and the money that the filmmakers get, is not the goal, but the means to the goal, and the goal is art. And when we do our job right, it's about going out there and finding something that never could have existed without this tool and making sure it exists.
Fantastic. Well, thank you. Again, we've been talking to the Kickstarter team, George Schmatz, Dan Schoenbrum. Did I do it better that time?
It was about the same.
And Liz Cook here on the Daily Buzz from the 2016 Sundance Film Festival in Park City. And you've been listening to us on KCPW and kcpw.org. You're listening to The Daily Buzz from the 2016 Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. We are on KCPW and kcpw.org. My name is John Wildman, and I'm here with our producer and co-host, Irene Cho. And we're going to talk to a filmmaker about a film that it's like my favorite thing so far. The film is The Lure. Our director, and I'm going to try to say the name correctly, Agnieszka Smoltynska.
Smoltynska.
Oh, so close. This film, I've been describing it as likely the only magical realism musical horror film about mermaids that you will see this year, if ever.
Thank you.
I almost don't know where to start, but we'll start with this. What came first, the mermaids or the music for you?
You know, the first came the protagonist, because the first moment I wanted to tell the story about two young girls who grows up in a dance club, because me as a small girl, my mom used to run two restaurants when they were musicians play music alive. And my friends, they are musicians, and we wanted to make this film together. And they also grew up in such a restaurant because their parents were musicians, and we started to work on a story about two girls who grew up in such a place. But one of them said, "Oh no, it's too close to us. It's too personal. I don't want to tell the story which tells about young girl. You know, the first cigarettes, the first, you know, the first sex and everything. It's too close." And that's why we decided to...
You went to mermaids.
Yeah, that's why we decided to make a film about mermaids, because mermaid is a metaphor of young girl. And it's like a mask. We can hide behind this. That's why we have mermaids.
All right, well, to catch our audience up very quickly. All right, so we have a family that's kind of like a little musical group.
Yeah.
And they are on a beachfront, and our two mermaids, gold and silver, come up and literally, and this is not a spoiler, because this happens in the first scene. They literally say, let us come on land with you, and we promise not to eat you.
Yeah, exactly.
And you go,
exactly.
Well, okay, if you promise you're not going to eat me, sure. All right, come on. And the film, I think, it does this wonderful job of balancing this giddy musical world that you create with that dread and that creeping dread of, well, they said they're not going to eat us, but you know, they kind of want to eat us.
Yeah, exactly. Because our mermaids are, you know, the mermaids like from Homer, not from Disney, the first, you know, the Ariel, and they devour people. And that's why we decided to make musical, but also a horror film and also a comedy, because our mermaids are hybrid. That's why we have a hybrid film.
Tell us about you, your background. How did you decide to become a filmmaker?
You know, when I was a young girl and I really grew up in such a restaurant, my mom, of course, she wanted me to be a manager of kind of restaurant. But I really like to watch performing. I really like to be singer. When I was 5 years, 6 years. After that, I want to be actress. But after, when I grew, I want, oh no, when I was 14, I decided I want to be director, a film director. So I'm here. It's my first feature film.
Congratulations. What an achievement for your first feature.
Yeah, it's true. And it's really, when we got to know that we come here to Sundance Film Festival, for everybody from my group, from my team, it was really shocked. And nobody believes us. And it was, you know, because our mermaids, in a story, they came to Poland. And after Poland, they want to, you know, just have fun. And after that, they want to go to America, to US, because there is, you know, the musicals. That's why they want to come here.
Well, seriously, what flesh-eating mermaid doesn't want to come to America? I mean, seriously. Well, you know, it's one of the reasons why I'm a big fan of the film is because you come to Sundance and you hope to see something unexpected. You hope to see something that is going to catch you completely awares. And again, as I've said it to many people, the lore, it strikes me as crazy in all the right ways. I'm also very curious as to what films influenced you.
What films, you know, to be honest, there was one film, because as you said, this is really very original film, very original genre, and there are some films. Of course, I like Tim Burton film, Sweeney Todd. Of course, I know, you know, there is the title for this particular movie. I think there were clips of Björk sometimes. To be honest, there were paintings of Aleksandra Waliszewska. It wasn't only films, but also paintings, photographs. I mean, the Diane Arbus, Nan Goldin, and also Sally Mann. So my inspiration was not only films, but the really arts, the visual arts, and also, of course, music. And music for me, very important, was music of these composers, the music band Ballade Romance. They are inspired in many, many, many music bands, also in Poland, but also from US, and you know, it's like this.
I'm also on the practical filmmaking level, talking about visual, is that you have mermaids, and so they have tails.
Yeah.
And can you talk about the challenges of, you know, of directing your actresses and your actresses having, because you're right, they're not Disney mermaids. I mean, you know, these tails are like long, huge, like, you know, snaky, kind of eel-like, you know.
Yes, it's not sexy fish tail. When we, you know, that's our film is. It's we were really thinking about what kind of fish tail we should have, because, you know, it's mermaids is like a monster, a half beautiful girl and a half a monster, and we want to tell the story, a failed story for adults. And I really was searching for such a kind of fish tail, and because of Aleksandra Waliszewska, she is a painter, this fish tail is huge. It's almost 2 meters long, and it's filled with slim and mucus, something. It's very
slime.
Wet.
Slime.
Yes, yes. That's what I have to learn by heart. Slime. And we had trainings with my actresses, because we built this this fish tail for 3 months from silicone, because we had practical models. And it lasts 3 months. And after that, they had to really go inside this model. But they had only 2 weeks or 1 day to be inside and behave like a mermaid. We have to really search, you know, the movement of her, how she feels. And
Did you try the tail too?
Of course. Of course.
You have the tail around, you got to try it.
You know, in a newspaper in Poland, I asked them, because they wanted to me, you know, have, okay, but only in fishtail. And of course. And the singer, in the one character, she also wanted to have this kind of fishtail. Yeah. Every girl wants to have a fishtail, I think.
And I think after people see the film, that many other people want to have those fish tails. Again, we've been talking to Agnieszka Smoltenska. I got it right that time. From the film The Lure. Again, congratulations on the film, and thank you for coming by.
Yeah, thank you very much for talking.
You're listening to The Daily Buzz from the 2016 Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. We are on KCPW and online at kcpw.org. My name is John Wildman, and I'm joined by my co-host, Kim Boyner, and our producer, Irene Cho. And right now we're going to talk to the filmmaker, Shimon Dutan, from the film The Settlers. And Shimon, for people who are listening have not had a chance, obviously, to see the film as of yet. If you can give us a quick idea, because this is a subject you've dealt with before in your films, in a general sense, but this film in particular, what is The Settlers? What are you looking at?
We hear a lot about the Israeli settlements in the West Bank. In the world imagination, it seems to be the obstacle to any peaceful arrangement in the region, which is, it is. Yet I find that very little is known about the phenomenon itself. And it's poorly understood, not only by the world at large, but by many Israelis as well. When I did Hot House, a previous film that was screened here at Sundance, I was traveling in the West Bank, and I came upon a roadblock that was initiated by the Israeli military, and they brought huge cement blocks to block the road to prevent settlers from crossing into Palestinian territory. And I saw settlers from a nearby settlement called Shiloh running and throwing themselves under these huge cement blocks to prevent the Israeli military from blocking their access with vehicles to the Palestinian territories. That was quite alarming to me. You saw these young men and women actually putting their life on the line for something that was quite obscure at the time. And for me as an Israeli, that was a kind of revelation. There is a new kind of extremism or fanaticism that is so prevalent in the West Bank today. And I thought that's something to be explored further. On top of that, the settlements are actually changing the tone that Israel is, the way that Israel is presenting itself vis-a-vis the world. And this is quite alarming, and I find it a real threat to Israel in many ways.
It's very interesting how in Hot House you addressed the fanaticism on the Palestinian side about how the Israeli prisons have become a breeding ground for terrorism. And now in this, you're addressing fanaticism from the other side. I'm wondering if you see it as a push-pull on both sides that needs to be addressed. Is that what drove you to make a film more specifically about the settlers and the Israeli side of the fanaticism?
Well, I do believe that the evolution in the region, in any place of conflict, is actually driven by the extremists. Those in the center or the majority almost have no voice in such a conflict. And for us to understand or to try to find some kind of a solution, we have to explore, to study the extremists. And as you said, rightly so, I did it with the Palestinian prisoners and Israeli jails. And in a way, it's the counterpart of those individuals in the Israeli settlements.
How did the settlers take your perspective when you approached them about making the film? Did they see you as being on their side? Did you approach it that you were going to be kind of neutral?
No, quite the opposite. And I was making it very clear with every encounter that I had with settlers that I am in opposition to their point of view, that I think that the settlements are a threat, a real threat to the very existence of the state of Israel. Not to its physical existence, but to its moral fabric and many other elements that will really damage the country in an irreparable way, I would say. But I made it a point to present my views because I didn't want to steal anything from them. I didn't want them to catch them, so to speak. And remarkably, they find it just the beginning of a discussion, and in a way that crystallized their idea even more in order to either convince me or to present a counter argument that gives, I think, a very thorough understanding of where they are coming from.
There's a woman in the film, Sarah, who features quite prominently throughout the film. Could you talk a little about how you got drawn to making her such a central part of your storytelling?
You refer to Sarah Nachshon with the baby?
The one with the baby.
Yeah. I often ask myself questions about the nexus between the individual and the national, the plural. Where does it cross? Where an individual attempt or action evolves or transforms into something that carries either a mythical or a bigger presence in a society. And what happened with this Sara Nahshol is quite remarkable. She was from the very first settlers that got into Hebron, which is the biggest Palestinian city in the West Bank. And she seems, on the face of it, not a very sophisticated individual, but she has a deep belief and very strong convictions. Her son, her second son, that was born in Hebron and was circumcised against all rules in the cave of the patriarchs, died of SIDS at the age of 5 months. She decided she wants to bury him in the old cemetery in Hebron, which was deep into the Palestinian side of the city of Hebron. She drove with her baby towards the cemetery, and the military put blockade to prevent her from doing so. She took the dead baby out of the car, and she started walking with the dead baby towards the cemetery. The soldiers could not physically stop her, could not bring themselves to physically stop her. And it became an issue as she was walking. It was quite a walk. And the issue came up all the way to the Ministry of Defense, and they've decided just to let her do it in a whimsical decision, not really thinking about the consequences of
it. But it did have a long-term impact.
Exactly. So what happened? The burial took place in the old cemetery of Hebron. Because there was a fresh grave there, the military had to position a platoon to protect the grave from being desecrated. Once the military platoon was there, the settlers that were out of Hebron at that time felt more secure and started to move more freely into Hebron. And that was the beginning of the Jewish enclave inside the city of Hebron, which is one of the most contentious spot in the whole West Bank. And we live it until this very day.
And it started from this mother with an emotional situation, exactly. Probably not even driven by the politics, right? She was... Or do you think that she was? Was she more politically driven?
I don't think that was so remarkable about it. And therefore I said earlier that I'm always intrigued by this point of transition where an individual will evolves or becomes something that become national, become mythical. And I find it that very often it's the starting point is very personal. Without any agenda to carry it to a further, I no doubt in my mind that she did not ever, at the time, was thinking that would be the
she
beginning.
She wasn't thinking, I'm going to carry my dead baby to be a political
exactly.
symbol, but it became
exactly.
that.
Yeah.
Well, wonderful. Listen, thank you, Shimon Dutan from The Settlers, for joining us, and congratulations on bringing your second film to the Sundance Film Festival.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Daily Buzz from the 2016 Sundance Film Festival here in Park City, Utah, on KCPW and online at kcpw.org. My name is John Wildman, and I'm here with our producer, Irene Cho. And here we have what was kind of like a traditional segment, which is kind of like the State of the Union from the Slam Dance Boys. Peter Baxter, Dan Mervish, and Paul Rackman. And all right, so I want you guys to get in one. I cannot wait to see Adam Rifkin's film, like so many people that you guys had add an additional screening because so many people were so excited about this film. So obviously a really good choice to open your festival. But I want you guys to have at and tell us what we can expect from this year's version of Slam Dance.
Peter?
Discovery. We're going to discover great new filmmaking talent at this year's festival. And I think it's one of the most exciting festivals we've ever had. And I think it's largely based on, we just heard a little bit about technology here from the Let's Be Evil team. But what we're seeing more and more are filmmakers who are experimenting with new technology. You know, we talked a little bit last year, I think, about the DIY film movement. And now what we're seeing is filmmakers really experimenting with new technology and crafting their stories. Let's Be Evil is one of them. But also, for example, we have this kind of a hybrid cinema piece called Pry, which is part of our DIG program this year. And it was made by Tenderclaws. And what's amazing about this is that the creators have used open source software to create this wonderful interactive piece. It involves documentary filmmaking, narrative storytelling, poetry, and it's all come together in this one piece. And we're seeing then more and more of our filmmakers experimenting, taking risks, being bold in creating their stories, being less concerned about what critics, the industry, think about these works at the festival this year, and more about this is who I am, and these are the stories I have to tell.
You know, I think though, you know, as I've gone through the schedule and some of the films that I've already seen, you know, they're like tried and true, I think, things that I expect out of Slam Dance, that I think that you guys are, you know, like Fursonas, the documentary about the furry community. I'm looking forward to seeing some furries on your guys' red carpet. You know, because
they'll put the carpet in red carpet
because of that doc. The Lesson, which is, you know, which is the type of horror film, a type of genre film that, again, that I think you guys specialize in, again, because, you know, it's smart, but also it definitely delivers the gore. And of course, Director's Cut, which you guys are opening with, which is just an audacious, you know, vision.
Well, anytime you can have Penn and Teller come to Slam Dance, you say yes, you know. So we're excited to have those guys and with Adam. But yeah, I mean, Slam Dance is still, you know, this is our, 30th, 40th year? I don't know, whatever it is.
We started it when we were 10.
Yeah. We started in 95. I mean, it's still focused on first-time directors with no budgets and no distribution in place, but a lot of them get distribution. I mean, you talk about genre films, Paranormal Activity got a deal out of Slam Dance, and it looks like some of our films this year have deals in the works that hopefully by the end of the week, you know, will materialize. So, yeah, we're excited to be back.
You know, you talk about the opening film, Director's Cut, but our closing night film is actually of particular interest, too. It's kind of a sci-fi film. It's called Embers, woman director Claire Carré. And this is a film that had already premiered at some smaller festivals, you know. Very good festivals, but, you know, smaller, not as much impact on the industry and press. And when we saw the film, and that's one of the filmmakers we had met at the IFP Labs, and it came back in and we remembered it, and it's so good that, you know, we've been premiere adverse for years now. You know, that's not one of the criteria for the festival, and it's really the perfect slot. Here's a filmmaker, Claire, with a great film, who's gone to a few festivals. The closing night slot is never an easy slot. You know, everybody's tired.
They want to get to the
festival. But we really wanted to support this film. It deserves a home. It's a really, really talented, woman filmmaker. And, and they're ready. You know, she's got the experience. They know what to do. And that's, you know, so we're bookending the festival with two great films. And
that's one thing that really distinguishes Slam Dance from, you know, I mean, why do we exist compared to Sundance or South By or anything else? And one of the things is that, you know, we're all filmmakers ourselves. All of us are working on projects. And, you know, we're like, you know, this rigmarole about premiere status, which a lot of festivals get very uptight about, is we're like, as a filmmaker, you're like, no, that's crazy. If it's a good film, it should keep playing. So we're proud to show that. One of the other things this year is we're back with the Hot Tub Summit on Tuesday.
I was wondering about the Hot Tub Summit myself.
Irene had to ask about that. So, yeah, we... You know, 2 years ago, it was so successful. We had about 30 people or 40 people or 50 that we threw off the PH, and someone called the PH cops, and it was shut down last year. But we're back. We've paid off the right people, and we're back this year. And so it's the wettest panel discussion in Park City. We're very proud of that.
You know, another thing in our programming we noticed this year is, you know, we usually do 10 films in the narrative competition, 10 films in the documentary competition. Well, this year, and documentary, even at Sundance and even with us, has always been at the forefront. There's been a lot of great filmmaking in documentaries. Really, you know, people have easier access. The subjects have been great. There's been political issues, social issues, you know, cultural issues. But this year, you know, the programmers decided that, you know, the narratives are really strong, and we programmed 12 narratives in competition and cut the docs back to 8, you know, and it was just the balance, you know. There were so many strong, the narrative programmers were so intent on these films, and the doc programmers were a little bit, you know, there's some films here that, yeah, we would program, but maybe... You know, so they gave up those slots, and we have that flexibility at Slam Dance because it's so intimate. And you could, you know, I mean, well, you see that happen all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it speaks generally. We've been hearing a lot about how cinema is is declining. You know, some filmmakers that are really well known say it's dying. Well, it's not. It's evolving.
Yeah.
Paul's point here about the narrative competition, I really think, demonstrates that. And going back to the point of experimentation, taking risks, and filmmakers not worrying, not being shackled by what they think they should make for the marketplace. They're making something which they're really passionate about.
And Slamrats is very international, too. Yes. And we mix in all of our foreign filmmakers with the Americans.
I want to point out a doc. Sorry to interrupt, but you know, we have an Italian documentary called The Successor, very much at the forefront of this kind of social issue type of documentary. The filmmaker couldn't come, so I just want to give it a little heads up here. I mean, this is a film about a man who inherited a business from his father that was basically an arms manufacturer in Italy, who made landmines that killed countless people, particularly in the Balkan Wars in the 90s. And this is a man who inherits the company and divests himself of the company. Out of that, he returns to the Balkans. He meets the people who were injured from the landmines his company made and helps clear these mines, you know? And this is such kind of like an example of where, you know, corporate responsibility and everything can go. You know, there is no way you would find an American CEO kind of like shut down his company on those issues, but this man did it. It's an incredible film. And it really is kind of pushing the edge to the next level of what we haven't found in that kind of filmmaking in the U.S.
I'd like to circle back to the comment that Dan made about international filmmakers. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important that you don't separate them and categorize mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that,
yeah,
Peter?
Absolutely. I think that what happened here when Slamdance first started, we took these great risks, financial ones as well, making our films, and this is part of the great independent film movement where the Americans do that, right? Make it happen. But what's happened since then is with technology like Dan's camera here, you know, it's become affordable, and this whole DIY movement then has spread internationally. And that's why we have so many then international filmmakers at Slamdance, because they've all embraced that. So whether you're making a film in Jakarta, we have a film made in Jakarta, it's, you can do it. You can buy that equipment, you can sit in your garage in your living room and make that wherever you are in the world these days. And that's what's really exciting about the program.
You should be presenting it side by side with the kid from Iowa is making a film.
I mean, the borders are down technologically, you know, so...
Oh, it makes sense.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So it totally makes sense.
The other thing too here, just to mention, is that, you know, diversity has been a real hot subject at the moment. Our programmers are filmmakers themselves, and as Slamdance has evolved, you know, we've asked, invited all of these programmers to come back, and now we're able to actually have successful programming internationally. You don't have to sit in the Slamdance office.
Yeah.
Skype is now playing its part in programming Slamdance. So yeah, that also is a reason why we're seeing more international films.
Fantastic. Well, again, we've been talking to the guys who have brought us Slamdance for... according to Dan, I think 40-some years now. But again, thank you, Peter Baxter, Dan Miravash, and Paul Rackman for coming by. And congrats again on what looks to be like another great year for you guys.
Thanks for having us.
So we're wrapping up day one of the Daily Buzz from the 2016 Sundance Film Festival in Park City, Utah. This show is made possible with the support of KCPW and our sponsors, Cloud Electronics, SoundCloud, Nadja and David Lockwood, Skull Candy, Cotopaxi, Pop Art Snacks, Angry Porcupine, Enki New York, Mountain West Hard Cider, You Offend Me, You Offend My Family, and The Market in Park City. Our producer is Irene Cho.